This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Our first question comes from Russ Jenkins, who asks, if neutrinos are the up-and-coming frontier in observations, will it one day be possible to use them to observe further back in time than the CMB, as the early universe was presumably transparent to neutrinos long before becoming transparent to photons?
Okay, yeah, so a bit of context to this. Nearly everything we know about the universe we discover through picking up different forms of electromagnetic radiation, so visible light, X-rays, radio waves, and so on. And of course, one of the challenges in astronomy is we can't easily go to these distant things and study them close up, so we're reliant on everything that arrives at the Earth to understand it. So, yeah, we do all that electromagnetic radiation, but there are other things that we could pick up from space. Maybe in the future, gravitational waves. We'd love to be able to use those to study the universe. But also particles. Cosmic rays are particles that come from the sun and other exotic objects in distant space, supernovae and active galaxies and so on. But neutrinos are a particular type of fundamental particle that are very interesting but extremely hard to detect. They basically interact very weakly with matter, which means you basically just can't catch them in a camera like you can very easily with photons. So extremely hard to do. But it is now possible to do it. Particle physicists have big neutrino detectors. So for example, there's a long-standing problem in astrophysics was whether we understood how the sun worked, because the theories of the nuclear reactions at the heart of the sun predicted a certain amount of neutrinos being produced. And we were basically not measuring the correct amount at the Earth. So, we discovered not that long ago really that in fact it's because neutrinos change type. There's different flavors of neutrinos, and when they change from one to the other, it turns out that because there were three types that we were aware of at the time, it meant that the numbers you observed were a third of what you expected, because they sort of changed from the original type into these two others as well. So you had a third of each type, and that was why these things didn't agree. So in the end, with that experiment, we showed that the astrophysics of the sun was right, and we showed that the particle physics was right too. Now, this question is about neutrinos and the Big Bang and the cosmic microwave background. Russ is right to say that when we look at the Big Bang with electromagnetic radiation, what we see is this cosmic microwave background, these microwave wavelength photons come from the time at which the universe first became transparent to photons, which was about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, so almost 14 billion years ago. And we see that, and we map that structure with spacecraft like the Planck spacecraft most recently. And he's absolutely right that the problem with that is that's as far back in time as you can see with the photons, because before that time the universe was opaque. It was denser and it was hotter and it was opaque to the light, so you can't see through that sort of barrier, if you like. But neutrinos are different, and the universe became transparent to neutrinos probably only a few seconds after the Big Bang, rather than 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And so in principle, if you could detect those afterglow neutrinos or relic neutrinos or whatever you want to call them that come from the Big Bang, you could study those earlier phases. Now, the problem with it is what I said at the beginning was the neutrinos are hard to detect. These ones are also very low energy, in fact, so they're even harder to detect than other types of neutrino. But interestingly, it is possible to calculate the effects that those neutrinos would have on the development of the structure of the matter that we then see in the cosmic microwave background maps. So we're measuring the details in the cosmic microwave background map of microwave radiation, like with Planck. And the structures you see are affected by the flux of neutrinos and the ripples in the neutrino flux. So although you don't see the neutrinos directly, you see their effects on these structures, and that has been done. And also for Planck in particular, for example, Planck appears to have confirmed that there are only three types of neutrinos, which might disappoint some particle physicists who wanted more, but there seem only to be three. And also you can use those observations to put limits on the mass of the neutrino. Because it used to be thought that neutrinos were massless, but because they change flavour between these three types, that tells you they must have some mass, and you're able to actually work out what the upper limit on the mass of a neutrino. It's actually 2 million times less massive than an electron. So they're not very massive, but we know they do have some mass, not very much, and you can measure it from these CMB, cosmic microwave background observations.
Our next question comes from Jerome Tremblay, who asks, one question I got from a 10-year-old is, what is quantum physics? How can you go about explaining the concept of that?
Yeah, it's a funny word, I suppose, quantum physics. It basically means a very small amount of something. A quantum is a small amount of something. And it basically goes right back to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And I suppose at the end of the 19th century, most people thought that physics was solved. They thought they'd worked out, for example, the great story of the 19th century was the story of the electromagnetic spectrum, actually, I think. Because right at the beginning, in 1800, William Herschel discovered infrared. So this was the first type of light beyond the visible. The year after ultraviolet was discovered. And then basically all the other bits of the electromagnetic spectrum were filled in. Right the way to the end of that century, in 1900, when Villard discovered gamma rays. And in the middle of that, James Clerk Maxwell worked out that these things were all electromagnetic waves moving at the speed of light. So that was all very exciting. And a lot of people thought, well, you know, we understand physics now. And there were just some little problems they hadn't quite worked out. And one of those was related to the type of spectrum you get from a hot, opaque object. So we call it a black body in physics, but you know, something like the sun, which is opaque, you can't see directly through the sun. A hot thing produces a spectrum that sort of rises and falls as you work your way through the different wavelengths or colours. And we couldn't calculate, physicists at the time could not predict the shape of that spectrum given the theories that they had. And it was actually Max Planck who was the first person to suggest, and rather than it basically being this sort of continuous thing, he suggested that in fact it came in packets in these small quanta, which is the plural of quantum. And basically from that point, all the people that you might have heard of, so people like Einstein, people like Rutherford, people like Niels Bohr, all these people picked up on that idea, and that was when quantum physics was born, was the idea that energy doesn't come in any old values, it comes in these packets. And Bohr, for example, worked out a quantum theory of the atom, of the hydrogen atom, that explained the spectral lines, the dark lines that we see in the spectrum of the sun, call them the Fraunhofer lines, that are caused by the absorption of light by atoms or molecules in the outer atmospheres of stars. So basically that's it. I mean, you know, the simple idea, the simple fundamental thing about quantum physics is that it's about not having a continuous range of something, energy in this case, but that coming in packets. And I suppose, you know, we talk about photons of light. Before that point, they wouldn't really have talked about photons of light because they'd have talked about them as waves. And that then turned into these packets of energy that we call photons. And all these sorts of theories that have come since then in particle physics, so quantum electrodynamics and quantum chromodynamics and string theory and all these things, these are all quantum field theories that are all about sort of using these quantum principles in order to understand the world around us. And it certainly seems to be that way. And we need quantum physics to explain the world. The big hole in that at the moment is probably a quantum theory of gravity, because we don't have a successful one of those which combines with the others, which would effectively give us this sort of much vaunted theory of everything. Whether that's possible or not, I'm not sure, but the closest we have at the moment is superstring theory, and that's not yet been proved.
Yeah, I know there's a method of kind of unifying the three major theories, but still not gravity, and it's still something that people really want to have.
It's something that Einstein spent after he'd done these amazing achievements in special relativity and general relativity. And just by the way, next 2015 is the 100th anniversary of general relativity, so we're coming up to that now, the last 100 years. But he spent most of the rest of his life trying to do that very thing, unify those theories, and didn't achieve it, even someone who was obviously as brilliant as Einstein. So it's not an easy task.
No, not at all. Our next question comes from Paul Saxon, who asks, in August 1977, Ohio State University's radio telescope received the now famous WOW signal. Unfortunately, the signal has never been detected again. Has the Mark 1 telescope ever checked the location of the WOW signal in the constellation of Sagittarius? And are there any plans to do some SETI research, such as scanning the Kepler exoplanets for any signs of extraterrestrial intelligence? So kind of two questions there.
And he added, thanks for a brilliant podcast,
He did.
So thanks for that, Paul. So yeah, the WOW signal is you know, it's well known in sort of SETI work, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And it was basically an observation that was made with a radio telescope in Ohio, as he mentions. And they were looking for these sorts of signals that might possibly have come from extraterrestrials. And they were measuring the strength of the signals as time goes by. And the classic printout of this that you'll find on the web if you Google WOW signal is a series of numbers which basically represent the brightness of the radio signal. So it's basically printing out the brightness on a print chart printout at the time. And then all of a sudden, within all this series of sort of ones and twos and things, which are low-level signals, faint signals, there's this sequence of numbers and letters. It goes 6EQUJ5.
What on earth does that mean?
So if you can imagine, they were scaling the brightness just with numbers. So 2 would be brighter than 1, 3 would be brighter than 2, and so on. But then we ran out of those single-digit numbers. They went on to letters. And so when this goes 6EQUJ5, what's happening is that brightness is going up and up and up and peaking at around U by the look of it, and then falling back down again. And so this was basically a bright radio source passing through the beam of that radio telescope. And this was really, you know, very bright around the near the wavelength of the hydrogen line in the radio spectrum at around a wavelength of 21 centimeters, which has been suggested as a place where you might look for alien signals, because it's the most abundant element in the universe. And if you're going to search the spectrum, you might look for these special places in the spectrum. You might define that as a special place. Of course, we don't know what the extraterrestrials would be transmitting or where they would be doing it, if indeed they exist at all. But that's at least a starting point. So this was discovered, and this was suggested as, you know, this was an interesting signal. Was this an extraterrestrial signal? And of course, the problem is people have gone back. They themselves went back, of course, and reobserved that location and nothing. And numbers of other people have gone back and reobserved that location and got nothing.
So it's literally just been observed that one time.
It was just observed that one time, and it lasted. It was a signal that lasted for about a minute or so, I think.
Quite a significant length of time.
Yeah. So it was a. But, you know, the trouble was it something coming from space? It seemed to have the properties of something coming from space rather than something that was local interference. But if you can't observe it again, it's very hard to make progress. Now, Paul asked, has the Mark 1 telescope at Jodrell ever checked the location of the WOW signal? For those who are wondering what the Mark 1 telescope is, it was the original name for the what we now call the Lovell telescope. So it was called that from 1957 to 1971. 1971, it got a new surface built on top of the old one, and so we called it the Mark 1A. And in 1987, on its 30th anniversary, it was renamed the Lovell Telescope in honour of Sir Bernard Lovell, obviously, who started the observatory. It's had another surface since then as well, but we didn't bother to rename it on that occasion.
Just kept the same name
and just had another nice, shiny, lovely paraboloidal dish, better than the one before. So I don't think we have. I don't know that we did. I have actually tried to look for signals from that direction of the WOW signal. Quite a lot of other people have, so I'm not sure that we would particularly have been any benefit in us doing that. In terms of doing SETI programs, the major SETI search that we were involved with at Jodrell was the Project Phoenix search, and that was run by the SETI Institute in California.
What's the Project Phoenix search?
So what they did was the clever thing about Project Phoenix, again, it's a radio SETI, so it's looking for radio signals from potential extraterrestrial civilizations, picked about 1,000 nearby stars and went through them one at a time. And the clever thing was that we used two telescopes. So for the part where Jodrell was involved, this was 1998 to 2003. Over that 5 years, we did this for a few weeks at a time, several times a year. Two telescopes. One was Arecibo in Puerto Rico, which is the world's biggest telescope, but so big you can't actually steer it. So it points pretty much straight up. And the Lovell telescope at Jodrell. And they both look simultaneously at the same star, the same direction to one of these nearby stars, sun-like stars. The trick for using two telescopes is basically there's two good reasons for doing it. One is that if you are going to be confused by interference that humans are producing, wherever it might be from, satellites or mobile phones or whatever, which would be artificial signals easily distinguishable from natural radio signals by the way in which they spread in the spectrum. If you use two telescopes that are separated, then you wouldn't expect to see the signal that you're detecting one in the other telescope, you know, because the distance is large enough. And the other clever reason about that is that actually, if you measure a narrow band signal, a sort of spike in the radio spectrum, you can measure the frequency at which it appears. Because these two telescopes are on different parts of the Earth's surface and the Earth is spinning, when you look in a particular direction, you get a different Doppler shift because the speed at which the telescope is moving relative to the object is different for the two different telescopes. And so, in fact, that signal, if it were indeed coming from space, would appear at a slightly different frequency in the spectrum. And so that would be another great pointer to it coming from outer space. And, of course, for that reason, the 1,000 stars didn't detect any alien signals. We haven't done any SETI since then, but we just started to do a new SETI project, actually, at Jodrell. It doesn't have a name. We should give it a name. should have a competition in the job. No, maybe. I don't know. So we've actually decided we're going to try and look at, I suppose, you know, thinking about the motivation for this, we don't know whether aliens exist. We might be the only life in the whole universe. Most people think that's probably unlikely. We certainly know there are billions of planets, even in our own galaxy, probably billions of habitable planets in terms of being similar to the Earth in terms of the temperature. You know, we don't know whether aliens are on them or not. We don't know whether they'd be transmitting radio signals. But if they are and we don't bother looking, that would probably be a bit remiss of us, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
So we felt that it would be quite a nice thing to do. Problem with it is, if you don't know there's a signal there, if you used up your telescope time continually on that, we could be there for the next 300 years or something, never detecting a signal, wasting all that telescope time because we've not done anything with it. So the trick is to try and get a system going that would effectively piggybacks on other observations, or perhaps uses a limited amount of observing time. And we're looking into that process. The technology we have now with eMerlin, it's a network of up to 7 radio telescopes across the UK, really lends itself to these sorts of SETI programs because it has a very wide bandwidth of spectrum. So we can see a huge range of different frequencies. And since we don't know where the aliens are transmitting, you have to look across a wide band. And we can also break that band down into very fine detail. And so we can then search for these narrow band signals, which many people argue is probably what we should be looking for. So that's what we're doing at the moment. Hopefully there'll be some more news about the details of that over the next coming months.
Okay, well, that's something to definitely look out for. And our last question comes from Peter Conway, who asks, if the tides are caused by the gravity of the moon, why is there a high tide on the side of the Earth furthest from the moon?
Okay, so it's a question that's often asked. And I suppose the one problem is thinking about everything as though there's a sort of, you know, an Earth and a moon attached to some sort of rod that holds them fixed. And you imagine the gravity of the moon pulling the water over the Earth, if you like, towards the moon. And then if you thought it was like that, then you would indeed expect to see a single bulge on the side of the Earth facing the moon, because all the water would be pulled more towards the moon. But in fact, that's not a fixed situation like that. You've got this rotating system. And if you imagine the force of gravity on different objects across the Earth, then you've got the greatest force of gravity on the side facing the moon. You've got a sort of medium force of gravity in the middle of the Earth, if you like, and the least force of gravity on the far side. And if you can imagine a situation like that, it means the water on the far side of the Earth is pulled less towards the moon than everything in the sort of middle of the Earth is pulled towards the moon. So in effect, what you end up with is a body of water that's sort of stretched out in an egg-like way, if you like, and the Earth sort of sitting more or less in the middle of that. And it's basically because of the differences in gravity across that whole surface. So you've got the bit that's pulled towards you more, produces the bulge on one side. The bulge on the far side of the Earth is actually because that water's pulled less towards the moon than even the Earth itself is in between. So I hope that makes some sense in a fairly quick answer to the question.
That makes perfect sense.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And if you have any questions that you want answering, then send them in via all the usual channels.